I was wondering if you could repeat a little bit of that story about moving the instrument up the stairs, or would you rather not tell that particular story?
Oh, no, I don't mind.
I think it's kind of a fun story about mass spectrometry in general and the things that people have to deal with when they receive instruments.
Is it on now?
Yeah.
Or I could probably tell it better at a second. Think about it. When the ZAB arrived, it had to come up a flight of stairs. That was the only possible way of getting it into the lab. Mm-hmm. And so the question was how to maneuver this, the foundation of the machine, the frame, up this flight of stairs, because it weighed an appreciable amount. And the way it was decided to do it was with a come-along, you know, that's a winch device with a lever, mm-hmm. and attach a cable to it, and haul it up on a wooden sledge. And we attached everything in the way that we thought it should be done, mm-hmm. and started to haul it up the stairs. And we noticed that while the cable was coming in, nothing was moving. And it turned out that the wall of one of the offices in the hallway, which we wished to enter, was being moved instead. So we had to stop and go back. And we finished up attaching the cable to one of the building beams in the ceiling of the hallway. Mm-hmm. Once we got the ZAB started on the stairway, we noticed that it wasn't going to get up because the stairway was just a little bit too narrow. Mm-hmm. The stair rail at the on one side was in the road. So there was no time for hanging about. It was probably about 9 o'clock at night now.
Now, my recollection is that the movement of this piece of equipment was to be done after 7.
That's right. The idea was the movement was done at a time when university authorities were not with us to interfere in any way. So we had to get an oxyacetylene torch and cut out the stair rails. And then finally get the ZAB upstairs, no problem, down the corridor on its wheels and into the lab. The stair rails were all welded back into place. A sledgehammer put the breeze blocks of the disturbed room back in their appropriate place. A quick dab of paint, and nobody noticed that the deed had been done. When I confessed all a very long time later, the chief officer in the dean's office was at first horrified and then amused, and pointed out that had we asked for any kind of official permission, it would never have been given. So I'm afraid that's very typical of activity where the devil drives, you must do it and get it done.
Well, I think probably just about every mass spec installation has some story along those lines because of the size of the equipment and the difficulty in getting it.
Yes, and so many go in through windows
as
well.
Yes. And then, as you mentioned before, the floor had to be removed and the other equipment.
For the MS-902, because that's quite a weight. That was well over a ton, several tons.
Stilts. And you also were mentioning the fact that you had a rain shower in the lab at one time.
Ah, in when we first had the ZAB and the 7070, the guy in the lab above ours, an organic chemist, was rather flood-prone. And on one occasion there was a very serious flood and the ZAB looked as if it had had buckets of water thrown over it when we came in. And needless to say, a great deal of circuitry was lost, and anything which had to carry 8,000 volts was a write-off. And anyway, when we got it all together again and was working properly, we got a large amount of heavy steel flex frame, a lot of solid plastic sheets like window glass, mm-hmm. and erected a series of permanent umbrellas over all the apparatus in the lab. We did have one more flood, but then fine, it just landed on the floor.
How long did it take you to get the equipment back underway after being...
We were down for 2 months. It was what a mess. And we did most of it ourselves.
Yeah.
We got parts from VG, but we had San Dimamas then. And mm-hmm. So that kind of work was not beyond us.
So before we left for lunch, you had just gotten the ZAB in the lab, I think.
It was of course a revelation of an instrument, because you could select an iron by its mass to charge ratio and do whatever the hell you liked with it afterwards. Mm-hmm. And in the earlier days, of course, all you could do was collision-induced dissociation and look at the unimolecular and metastable iron mass spectra. Fred McLafferty then produced a paper in which he had admitted a beam of mercury vapor in a collision cell and neutralized the ions in flight, and then with another collision with an inert gas a little further along the way, the high velocity neutrals were reionized. And this was great, because here was Fred doing it on a commercial instrument. The technique had been introduced at Cornell by a guy called Porter, who was a chemical physicist, who had made an extremely simple homemade apparatus in which he actually used sodium vapor to neutralize very small hydrocarbon ions. And in Dick Porter's lab, it was a bit of a curiosity, but Fred clearly had the idea that we could make wonderful exotic neutrals perhaps this way. And the kind of thing that had come out of Porter's experiments were that it looked as if CD5 represented a stable neutral. And it turned out that is a kind of quasi-neutral. What it is protonated methane, or rather deuteronated per-deuteromethane, with a spectator electron in a high Rydberg state, N equals 25 or something, of the carbon atom. And so it thought it was an ion at its core, but it behaved as if it was a neutral entity.
So you're saying it had this electron...
The electron was in a high principal quantum number, sitting out way up there, you see. So the whole thing was neutral, but the...
CD5 knew the electron was there.
Yeah.
But maybe you weren't so sure. I mean, from the outside, you didn't really...
From the outside, you thought it was neutral.
Yeah.
But it was clever enough to know that it was an ion at its core. And so in some of our own research, some completely unexpected things turned up. Because if you protonate dimethyl ether, if you make protonated dimethyl ether, so the proton is on the oxygen atom in the middle, and if you do a neutralization experiment, you'll find to your shock that the neutral, CH3OHCH3, apparently is stable, but it too is a Rydberg species with the electron in a high principal quantum number circuit of the oxygen atom. And so these high Rydberg quasi-neutrals pop up from time to time. And one experiment that we were quite fond of was reionizing these by field ionization. And we made a little field ionization grid, which involved investigating in the States to find out the finest possible metal mesh that we could establish. And there's a company somewhere in the States called Buckby Mears Corporation. And they produced this mesh. I think it was copper. It had 8 strands to the millimeter and more than 70% transmission.
Wow.
So it was visible, but it was as fragile as a spider's web. The only way we found that we could move it around was in alcohol. If you tried to take it out dry, it would electrostatically, curl up on itself and disintegrate. But if you kept it in a puddle of alcohol, you could move it around safely. And so Sander put it on a ring, and then one on an adjacent ring, spot welded with little supporting rings. Mm-hmm. We were able to bring the two together to within just less than a millimeter.
Wow.
And when everything was properly evacuated, we could put 2 kilovolts across. And so the field was
tremendous.
20,000 volts per centimeter, and that was enough to field ionize these Rydbergs.
So we got
the ions back.
It seems you also had the chance of having an arc development and wiping out.
I'm afraid the experimental lifetime of the gear was quite short, but you could get one which would last about a week before something shorted it out and blew it away.
So the idea is the high electric field between the two grids was sufficient to take that Rydberg.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And then you ended up
with a high velocity ion, and on it goes.
Esoteric experiment, I think, would be.
It was a fun experiment. The field ionization came about because way back there was a topic that was developed in the UK called field ionization kinetics, which was developed in London. Field ionization kinetics, and the main architect of it was a guy called Peter Derrick,
mm-hmm.
who you may have heard of, Derrick.
Mm-hmm.
Peter Derrick's now in New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, while he was in London, while he was doing his PhD and later on, he did these field ionization kinetics experiment, which meant you had to build yourself a field ionization source.
Mm-hmm.
And the way you did it, you would write, for example, to the Schick razor company, and you would ask for untreated razor blades. And I remember when we asked Schick for some untreated razor blades, we said, you know, half a dozen would be fine. And so, of course, they sent us a set of 50,
mm-hmm.
which was huge overkill. But the untreated razor blade had not had a silicone deposit on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you put this in vacuo and put a very high voltage on it,
mm-hmm.
and admitted something like, for example, pyridine,
mm-hmm.
Little carbonaceous dendrites would grow on the surface, on the tip of the razor blade,
mm-hmm.
on any sharp points. And so this made a wonderful field ionization source. And we built a little device for the MS-9 as a field ionization source. So we ran field ionization spectra in the MS-9 with this razor blade thingy.
How long did it take you to grow your dendrites?
A few hours. You couldn't see them.
Mm-hmm.
You needed a microscope to be able to see them. And then you could easily see the little fingers sticking up.
Yes, the field ionization seemed to have a lot of promise, but I think a lot of people were put off by the...
It's so easy to destroy your field, your device, because if it shorts out anywhere, it's lost.
Yeah.
So if you had to take the source apart every time you wanted to do a new sample, that was not very... And then wait a couple of hours for the dendrites to grow. This wasn't very practical.
So Derrick was doing this work in the UK.
He did this in London. He and I shared an office in 1973 at University College when I was on a sabbatical leave.
Okay.
And we became good friends then. And he was working on field ionization at the time.
And you decided then to use this as an ancillary technique in your reionization experiment.
That came a lot after. That was the only FI thing we did for the ZAB.
Mm-hmm.
For the MS-9, we made a conventional field ionization source with a razor blade.
Now you're still doing, there's part of the lab that's still doing routine analytical mass spectrometry in, during his period.
Down there?
Yeah.
Oh, yes, so, yes, yes.
And during your whole period, with all these other things that we've been talking about on the research side,
yeah,
there was he was still doing analytical work for people who needed that.
It wasn't my problem. I had Clem Kazakov, mm-hmm. who was an ace, mm-hmm. at getting just about anything into the mass spectrometers, mm-hmm. and getting a mass spectrum. Mm-hmm. So he had all the methods at his fingertips.
Did this activity bring funds into the?
Yes, we had contract work. Mm-hmm. We took in order to keep everything running. We needed a fair influx of money, and so we did contract work for industry and for universities which hadn't got a good mass spectrometer. Mm-hmm. So it was a continuous run of outside work.
Were the Ottawa departmental chemists able to get their samples run free of charge, or did they have to pay an annual charge?
And in the early days, it seemed right and proper that it should be free. Mm-hmm. But Carleton University and this university decided unilaterally that they weren't going to support us anymore, mm-hmm. because they'd heard we had contract money, mm-hmm. which was about a quarter of what they gave us, but never mind. NRC went into one of its terrible bureaucratic times, and we were cut swiftly. Mm. Said this is not right. We shouldn't be giving money. So we were down to nothing, except for contract work. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so the question then came: maybe we should introduce a departmental charge of $2 a sample. Which you can imagine the meeting. Nobody really wanted $2 a sample, but it was a question of take it or go without. So they agreed to $2 a sample. I think it's 25 now. That's not my problem, but the whole question of keeping equipment running is something that the granting agencies don't want to know about. They'll say, oh, no, it's the responsibility of the receiving institution. Mm-hmm. And the receiving institution said, this isn't any good, we haven't got any money. This equipment may all go to waste if we don't get support from mm-hmm. the granting agency. Well,
so this would be paying the heat electric bills type money?
No. No, this is to keep everything running. Yeah. This is to what happens when the electron multiplier dies, anything, any part, filaments, you name it. It's quite expensive,
yes,
to keep everything ticking,
yes,
over.
So you didn't get any help from the university after a certain period of time, and everybody else seemed to abandon you, so it's a matter of charging more money. But
that's right, and we had to raise the external fees.
Yeah, definitely.
So Carleton and NRC found themselves having to pay far more than they were pleased with, but it was, when the devil drives.
Well, but I mean, you were also delivering the product, right? I mean, the lab was producing it,
yeah,
and people got what they paid for.
Yeah, that's certainly true.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, how heavily involved were you in this funding activity, or trying to work out the funding issues? Were you?
It was my problem.
Okay. Mm. Now, you kind of basically, when you got this instrument early on, you kind of became the mass spec go-to person. Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
You were recognized amongst the faculty and the staff that this is, he's...
That's right.
Mr. Mass Spec.
Yeah.
So the development, evolution of the lab and the research and so on, that basically is all under your tutelage.
Is all
under your tutelage.
Yes,
direction.
Yes.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. Well, it sounds like you were started out on a good step with the authorities, but then money became tight and things got less friendly.
Yes, yes. The granting agency, at the time we got the ZAB, had just begun a series of support, which they called infrastructure support, which meant keeping everything going. And we got an infrastructure support grant from them, which I think was about $25,000 or $30,000, which partly paid for the salary of the analytical mass spectrometrist, and the rest went into... We had to pay for liquid nitrogen then, because the traps were cooled with liquid nitrogen. We hadn't got turbos. We had liquid nitrogen cool traps on the older instruments. So I'm afraid the money side was became a bigger and bigger headache.
Yeah, that's a shame.
As it, I'm sure it does everywhere.
Yes, and funding is getting to be a bigger and bigger headache everywhere these days. Yeah, do you know if the lab still gets industry support from outside in terms of samples submitted?
Yes, I was talking to Sharon the other day, who's Clem's successor, and she has I'm sorry, I forgot. We have some work coming in from outside. I'm not sure whether it's industrial or university. It could also be from a government lab. We used to do stuff for Environment Canada from time to time.
So basically you're kind of out there doing the old marketing thing, trying to get money to come into the from outside.
Yeah.
Keep the place, yes. Keep the lights on, yeah. Keep the people there, yeah. Keep going. Well, not fun, but it's something that's important to do.
I was on the National Chemistry Granting Committee for one term, a 4-year term, and I'll make this very brief. There were three kinds of application you could make. One is for major installations, like a big mass spectrometer, NMR. The second is apparatus funding. And the third is operating funding. Operating funding pays the grad students and buys the chemicals and the low-end stuff. The middle apparatus funding, you wanted a GC mass spec that cost $90,000. You put the application in there. And the idea was that the chemistry committee would receive this stack of middle equipment applications, and we'd be divided into three teams, and between us we would go to every department in the country and to inspect these individual requests, because you know and I know that you can write bullshit on paper, and the reality, when there's a guy sitting opposite the desk, he either knows what he's talking about or it's a come on for a piece of equipment he'd like to have. So we would do this tour, and I thought it was hugely valuable. Not only did you pick out the people who had written a bullshit grant, but you also picked out the people who were not very good at writing grant applications but had a super idea they wanted to wanted to run. So it seemed to me fair and just. Well, when I left the chemistry committee, I was called back 2 years after, because they'd called in outside consultants who were looking at the costing of the grant process. And the outside consultant said, all this travelling around the country at public expense, huge waste of money. So I tried to point out the case that if you didn't do this, you might as well stand at the top of a tall stairway, toss them down, and pick the ones that fell furthest, because you had no idea whether this was a good... No, they didn't like it, so we lost that. We lost that. And it really worked. It really worked. And I can give you a quick example. Big university, big chemistry department, 50 members. Three guys might ask for the same piece of equipment. No communication between them. The chair of the department has insufficient nous to say, look, you three, put in one, you'll get it. So you'd go to the committee, and Joe and Fred and Charlie would come in one after the other, and they'd say, I need this GC mass spec for this reason. And so, well, why didn't you write an application with Charlie or Fred or all three of you. I never knew he was doing it. Mm-hmm. So you'd have to listen to their three cases, and he who spoke best got one on condition that he shared it with the other two. Mm-hmm. Now, that mechanism is destroyed mm-hmm. by having no input from a committee.
It's a but, you know, the consultant came up with the result.
I know, yes, yeah. It wasn't a lot of money either. It was $40,000 it cost.
Yeah.
And think of the money it saved at one piece of equipment.
Yeah. Well, I...
Twas ever thus, yes.
So let's continue with your scientific career. When did you get into the visualization, reionization? That was pretty much later on, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was...
Before that, you were working on just...
CID and energetics, because Fred had moved all his equipment. Fred Lossing was here.
Okay.
And his equipment was installed downstairs, he was a super guy to work with, because Fred's approach was, there is no such thing as a silly idea until we've chewed it over carefully to make sure that it's silly. And so he and I and Hans Talau, if I was in Holland, Hans and I would pick up the phone and call Fred. Hans would pick up another phone and we'd have a three-way conversation about what we're going to measure next and why. And yes, that was a wonderful collaboration.
Was it anybody coming to blows during these conversations?
No. If we were sitting here and had a cup of coffee, we'd put the world to rights before we got on with the science. And Fred was a wonderful colleague, because he was knowledgeable, he was supportive, and as often as not, he'd suggest for him a better experiment than the one we'd propose that he do.
Did he spend his whole career at NRC?
When he retired from NRC, we brought his gear on the back of a truck, first of all to the adjacent building and then into the lab here. Okay. So I suppose we worked together for 10, 12 years or more.
Oh, okay. So this kind of triumvirate of intellectual discussion was able to resolve issues and get...
There was usually something would come out of any discussion that would say what to do next, what looked like a decent experiment to do next.
Did you like go through this exercise every time you decided to go into a new... world, so to speak?
Well, very often one would follow on from another. It would be a continuation, or it would be an offshoot. In Hans's laboratory, I wasn't there at the time, but they did the following experiment. They took propane, 1,3-diol. Propane 1,3-diol.
Where are my glasses? I ended up with a 4 in that glass.
Oh, there they are, yeah.
Excellent.
And propane 1,3-diol, when ionized, loses a molecule of formaldehyde. It loses CH2O. And the ion that's left behind has a formula, C2H6O. C2H6O.
That's an interesting fellow.
Right. Now, if you go to your chemistry textbooks, you say that's got to be ethyl alcohol or dimethyl ether, because there ain't nothing else. I like the way science works. It's not a major peak in the mass spectrum, mass 46. But Hans saw it was there and he thought, oh, well, that's a surprise. I can dream up a way where ethanol could be produced from this molecule. But let's have a look at it and see what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So with the Zab, of course, you can mass separate the iron.
Mm-hmm.
And he found to his horror / astonishment that all it did was to lose water.
Hmm.
And so what the hell is it? It's not ethyl alcohol, because that loses a hydrogen atom and a methyl group and
mm-hmm.
stuff. And it's not dimethyl ether, because that only loses a hydrogen atom. It's got to be something else. So it's something for which there isn't a neutral equivalent.
Mm.
And so on discussion, we decided it's an ethene ion, C2H4 ion,
mm-hmm.
with a water molecule, a dipole, attached to the iron.
Mm-hmm.
So Hans discussed this with me, and I said, well, we must rush to the lab and see if we can make the ammonia, halogen acid, hydrogen sulfide analogues.
Oh, wow.
By choosing the appropriate molecules.
Mm-hmm.
And in every case, it worked.
Mm.
And the ions lost the formal ethene adduct, HCl or H2S or ammonia and so on.
Mm.
Yeah, well, they're iron molecule complexes.
Yeah.
And we reckon, you know, this is a whole new field. This wasn't true, of course. This was wrong.
Mm.
And the way that it came about that it was incorrect was, I was in Australia and at a meeting there, and there was a poster presentation, which was a combined theoretician and experimentalist presentation. And it was all about some halogenated compounds. And right at the bottom, Leo Radom, who's a theoretician at Sydney,
mm-hmm.
had got a little additional results of ab initio calculations
mm-hmm.
show, for example, that CH2OH2 ion is more stable than ionized methyl alcohol. CH2OH2 is thermodynamically more stable, by calculation, than ionized methyl alcohol.
Hmm.
So I was chatting to Leo about it, and I said, Leo, I know how to make that. I know how we should try to make that. So he said, well, the experimentalist he was working with said, yes, we've got an idea too. So I said, well, why don't we compare notes, and if it all works out, we'll publish side by side.
Hmm.
Yes, worked. Bang. And so that's how dystonic ions came
mm.
into being.
Mm-hmm.
So it was obvious that the ions we'd called iron dipole complexes
mm-hmm.
were really dystonic ions, where the charge and the radical site are on separate atoms.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was Leo's name, dystonic, for the ions. And I guess in the next few months we must have made, I don't know, 20 or more. And Fred Lossing measured their heats of formation, and,
mm-hmm.
and wow. And of course they're all over the place. They're commonplace entities. No neutral equivalent, of
no.
course.
No.
But thermodynamically more stable than the conventional structure.
So that's kind of like a gas phase oddity.
Yes, they're totally
yeah.
unexpected.
Yeah, weird.
So there's, well, almost before you think of other things, you write a little formula, and oh dear, is there a dystonic counterpart I can write? And the chances are that the one you write is going to be the iron in question.
Mm, interesting.
So I collaborated with Leo on other ventures of this kind.
So this shows the utility of going to meetings and reading posters.
Yeah, well, yes.
But you're saying this was like a footnote?
This was just a footnote on something else which wasn't particularly interesting. But it just caught the eye, I thought.
Now, if that paper had been given in an oral session, maybe that interaction would never happen.
That's possible.
Yeah.
That's quite possible, because the footnote, there might not have been time for the
mm-hmm.
footnote.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And I guess the author was there at the poster session, so he could...
Yes, Leo. I remember the other guy, no, it was a fellow called Willem Baumer.
So you're able to...
So we're able to talk about it right away, and that's why I said, Leo, hey, I'm pretty sure I know how we could make that. And he said, yes, we think we could probably make it in the lab. So I said, well, you go home and I'll go home, and we'll keep in touch.
Well, the old scientific meeting comes in good for something.
Yeah, yes.
So
yes,
how hard was it to get to these guys? You've been to scientific conferences in Australia and all around the world. Is it easy to get funds for travel to the scientific conferences?
No, I have to confess that most of them were invitations, and it wasn't my pocket. The Aussie ones were invitations, mm-hmm. and Israel and mm-hmm. and so on, and New Zealand. So
You know, that helps.
Yes, it does help. It does help.
What about, for instance, your students? Were they able to go to conferences pretty easily?
Yes, for ASMS, we used to take as many students as we could afford.
Mm-hmm. How big of a stable of graduate students did you have?
Never very large. When I shifted over to mass spectrometry and stopped doing photochemistry and gas kinetics, I only had postdocs for a few years.
Okay.
And then I had one, two, maybe maximum four graduate students. Because apparatus time is not infinite.
Yeah.
And besides, I kind of lived in the lab as well. It was, you know, it was great to be with the students and looking over their shoulder and saying, "What's that then?" Mm-hmm. And it was good liaison. Mm-hmm. Nice.
So this was your mentoring style, was to kind of be close by and.
It was very hands-on, really, because. And Fred was in the lab too, but his lab was adjacent. Mm-hmm. And so they could drop in and chat. Fred was always ready for a chat about anything. So they'd drop in and say, "We've got this silly result." And say, "Have you told John about it?" "No, we thought we'd tell you first." And so it was good. It was really nice.
Skeptical?
No. I'd like to see the run again, of course.
Particularly if it was an unexpected result.
Particularly a completely unexpected result. Because one of the problems, as you well know with mass spectrometers, it's not too difficult to get an artifact by some means or other. Mm-hmm. Ooh. Mm-hmm. Shouldn't be any signal there at all. Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
So you continued, you said the early graduate students were some of your best students earlier in your career when you were here. The graduate students were very, how would you say, excellent, I guess, in the beginning of your career. You mentioned earlier that some of them were, you know, quite stellar.
The success of a graduate student, in my opinion, depends on how much you interact with them.
Okay.
If they're left on their own, and there isn't even a senior postdoc in the lab, and with complex equipment, they need somebody to talk to. Mm-hmm. They need to be able to ask silly questions every day. And of course, one out of the 10 is a super question.
So there's no question that is beyond being asked.
No. I go with Fred. There's no such thing as a silly question. It means something isn't understood. Mm-hmm. I mean, it may be a little silly, but it means there's a gap, and you better fill it.
Mm-hmm. So it's a way of educating. If it's a silly question, and if it's not a silly question, it's a way of...
That's right, yes, absolutely.
It's interesting, because some people's style, I remember when I interviewed Al Neer, his advisors, Tate, essentially just, you know, left him at his own devices and didn't interact with him hardly at all.
That works. Mm-hmm. That works, but not with the majority of students. Mm-hmm. Now I can think of students who were sufficiently self-motivated to take the next step, mm-hmm. and do it, and then come and tell you all about it. Mm-hmm. And of course, they're the better ones, mm-hmm. but there's still endless interaction with them.
I assume that eventually, as a result of the interactions, they get to become more independent and able to proceed.
Yes, indeed, indeed. They're more likely to have ideas of their own then.
So you're talking about most of the graduate students who have a typical tenure of what, three years.
Some longer, some 3 years plus.
3 years is a pretty.
3 years is an average. Yes.
And when you came, Ottawa University was a fairly small institution.
Yeah, it was.
So that was like 50 some odd years ago, right?
Yes, it is. Ooh, yes.
So how is it size-wise now compared to then?
Oh, the first year class is, between 10 and 15 times bigger. Mm. And the fourth year honors class, 3 times bigger. Mm. It tells you that the bottom of the pyramid has no business here at all. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Provincial exams are now run by the schools. The final exams in the province of Ontario, grade 13, mm-hmm. were set and run by an education committee which consisted largely of university professors. Mm-hmm. And the exams were set independently of the schools. The curriculum was there, and the marking was done by the professoriate. Marking grade 13 papers is a huge chore, mm-hmm. but it meant that you got a fairly reasonable bell curve of results. Mm-hmm. Whereas now, of course, with the high schools having the major responsibility in grading, the whole thing is up in the A and A plus region, and so the measurement is destroyed. It's the same everywhere. The marks have been pushed up and up. I can remember getting a note from the dean's office saying that my results for Christmas exam of physical chemistry, I don't know, say 100 students, didn't fit a bell curve. So I simply wrote back and I said, no, there's a really stupid non-working core in this group, and so they deserve their 40%. So I didn't hear any more about it. But the pressure was, come on, your score should be normal.
So they wanted the bell curve on the high side and your bell curve was on the low side.
It just so happened, yes, an untalented group or a lazy group, mm-hmm. who hadn't got off their butts by the Christmas exam. Mm-hmm. The end of the year looked much better. Mm-hmm. But the idea that there's a statistical norm and everything, mm-hmm. you know, it's a shame, isn't it?
So when you say grade 13,
there are 12 grades now.
Okay.
Grade 13 was really the university entry year, and the exams you took at the end were about the equivalent of the school leaving higher exams in the UK.
So graduating from university?
No, graduating from high school into university. Yes. Yeah.
Okay. And the grade 12 would be below that.
Right, yes. And grade 12 is where it ends now. Mm-hmm. So a lot of first-year university is making up for what they didn't get in grade 13.
Mm-hmm. 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 Interesting. What about mathematics in your career? Is that, in the scientific career, mathematics is important, but did you have to take additional math or...
Only as a pre-degree subject. Mm-hmm. I don't think I've... Do I use... Well, of course, most people use computational chemistry now in order to find a quick answer to a problem. And depending on the level of theory, sometimes you get a good answer and sometimes you do not get a good answer. But it's not a sphere I've immersed in.
So how big is the chemistry department at this point?
Now? Oh, there may be maybe 20 finals honours year students. And if you second year phys chem, it's a bit of a guess, but I would say there are probably 600 students in second year phys chem. From 2,000 plus first year students. The engineers don't have to do a second year phys chem anymore. The biochemists do, and so everything, the curriculum gets messed with at the lower levels.
Would phys chem be considered as a kind of a filtering course to?
It's reckoned to be tough, and there's a lab course with it. Which is really very entertaining to dream up a large number of physical chemistry experiments that don't get in trouble with health and safety.
So the whole educational experience has kind of evolved into a completely different beast compared to when you first got.
Well, it's mass production now. It's mass production.
And what about the nature of the student body? It seems like, in, you know, walking around the halls, there seem to be a fair amount of what I would classify as either foreign faces or people from the Asian area.
Quite right. That's their work. That's their family work ethic. You'll find that many Asian, Indian, and Middle Eastern families reckon that their children will get on through pursuing education. And so there are quite big familial pressures. And if you want to see a work ethic, just take an average Chinese student. They may not be very bright, but they work their socks off. They work extremely hard. And as grad students, it's quite difficult to get them to go home because they feel they've got to do the next experiment.
Now, are these Canadian citizens, or are you getting Chinese students from
Both. Countries? Both. Both. A change has happened. Up till about 10 or more years ago, if a Chinese student came from China, they would do their PhD, and particularly if they were a good student, they'd do a postdoc. And if they stayed in Canada, they would become Canadian citizens. With China a rather different place now, far more of them go home again. Many of them to academic positions. Several of my old Chinese students are in Chinese universities.
So if the change has occurred like in the last 10 or 15?
I would say 10 to 15 years, that change has been quite sharp.
Yes, that's China is an interesting story, the evolution of their society and kind of meshing with the West and getting...
But education was always rated high and respected in China.
So did you have any serious, negative experiences with the administration here over your career, or was it all roses and... good times? Anything you can talk about?
There's nothing I would particularly like to record.
Okay.
But there have been some pretty stupid things happen here, really. Unprofessional things. But then I suspect that's That's the same in many universities as the bureaucracy gets bigger and bigger and bigger.
So the old Oblate Fathers ran a pretty loose ship compared to...
They did. And then the first influx of administrators were often quite skilled in their own right. A major change that happened in the official attitude of the university was when bilingualism became an article of faith. And we now have to give all courses up to graduate level in both official languages, which I have no difficulty with saying this at all, which for the sciences is kind of silly, because if you're going to publish anything in science and you insist in putting it in compte rendu, even if it still exists, you are heading for obscurity, because you should be able to you should publish in English, where the rest of the world is going to read it. So it's an emotional, nationalistic kind of thing that the place should be bilingual. And Canada its policy is one of supporting bilingualism. That's fine, but in science it makes a burden, because sooner or later any budding young scientist whose native tongue is French is going to have to learn to communicate in his chosen field in English. And sooner is rather better than later. But as a university, we have to provide this parallel program. So that makes hiring staff quite difficult. Because it's no good hiring somebody who has some facility in French. You want somebody with a bloody fantastic vocabulary in French if he's going to try and describe abstract ideas in French. He needs the kind of vocabulary that one needs in English to get these across.
Right. Is this a provincial directive, or is it a Canadian directive?
It's a university thing.
But is it the province?
This university is a bilingual university. Carleton is not. If you work in the National Capital Region, it's very advantageous to be fluently bilingual, because it'll get you a job, almost certainly. Whereas if you're unilingual, it'll be more difficult. My wife tells a story that goes thus. If she goes into town to go shopping, and she goes into a dress shop, and if the assistant comes up and says, "Ah, bonjour, madame, comment ça va?" She knows that she's looking smart and respectable. If she goes in and she just kind of dressed in an ordinary kind of way, they'll say, "Hi, can I help you?" But it's very true. It's very true. If you go to Montreal, you will see that on the whole, the ladies dress with a bit of French flair.
My impression is that the eastern part of the country is much more into the bilingual thing than as you go.
No, not Nova Scotia. I don't think Nova Scotia is very, or New Brunswick maybe, but Quebec. It's essential that you're francophone to be in Quebec. It's nice. It gives a it enriches the country. But it makes life complicated at the learning science level.
Yeah, so the university is a bilingual school.
Yes,
so all the
yes.
instructors, the teachers, the professors, they have to demonstrate. Do they have to demonstrate some facility in French and English?
If they are going to teach in French, their French had better be bloody good. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult, of course, to write a a middle-of-the-road requirement. Mm-hmm. So, for example, Sharon, who's taken over from Clem Kazakov, she's a Brit, mm-hmm. and she doesn't have a second language. Mm-hmm. Clem's second language was Russian. Mm-hmm. When Sharon was hired, she was told, well, we expect you to be bilingual, even though the number of people who would come down from any of the laboratories with a sample who would insist in speaking French is vanishingly small. Mm-hmm. So it's a matter of policy that she has to be at least functionally bilingual. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, if you're going to have a discussion about the significance of this peak at mass 47, yeah. you don't want to have to struggle with yeah. schoolgirl French or conversational French of how is the hockey team doing. Yeah. it's difficult.
What's her last name?
Sharon?
Yeah.
Curtis.
Okay, right. Two S's?
One S. Curtis.
So, that's an interesting requirement. And I guess you're out of the loop now. And you're American,
it's not my problem.
It's not your problem.
No.
You recall the time when this was done exactly, when they went to this bilingual?
Oh, geez. Well over 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. Let me think. I would think at least 30 years ago.
Wow.
Because, yeah. Yeah, because in the arts faculty, it had always been taken for granted. And so the administration saw these people over in science all rabbiting away in English, and felt that something must be done to increase the bilingual nature of the science courses, and it's very easy to justify. But in the first stages, it was done very clumsily. Mm-hmm. And we had some memorable staff meetings where this was to be imposed upon us in a rather silly fashion. Mm-hmm. But on the whole, it works. It's expensive. It reduces the number of candidates that you can have for an academic position. In terms of their scientific ability, never mind their linguistic ability,
yeah.
And it does not act as much of a service for the students who are going to graduate and mm-hmm. go out into the real world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And if most of their knowledge of science is in French, they're not going to get a job in Milwaukee, are they?
No.
Mm-hmm. So it's a political thing. So.
Yeah.
And it, very emotional, of course, for French Canadians.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Interesting. This is a problem we don't have in the States, at least not
no.
in this place.
No.
I think close to the border there's some bilingual issues, but that's another story in the South.
Mm. Oh, yes, right, the Spanish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's amazing how much many packages you can pick up in the store and have Spanish instructions as well in the United States. So that's
That's right, yes. Most of the gear you buy, when you open the little book, you say, oh, here's the Spanish stuff. Yes, that's right. English and Spanish and
yes,
some French,
because yes,
it's in Canada.
So your funding landscape has kind of gotten sufficiently more challenging than it used to be.
Yes.
I think that's probably just a given for everyone in the sciences these days. And you've had good academic, experiences in your relationships with other academic institutions in Canada.
Yeah. Oh yes.
And
yes.
Industrial
yes.
Institutions.
Yes. Yes. I by. By happenstance, I found myself consulting for Burroughs Wellcome and then Glaxo for analytical chemistry.
That's good.
For patent infringements in pharmaceuticals.
Uh-huh.
and that was a hole. That was a window on another area of a completely different kind. Mm-hmm. That was fascinating. Mm-hmm. I got quite a lot of travelling out of that to come here.
This was the year that you go to the UK for...
For Burroughs Wellcome, it was UK. For Glaxo, it was mainly the UK. Uh-huh. And then there's Research Triangle.
Oh, okay.
But it... yes, it was a different light on science. And quite difficult in a court proceeding to produce a proof of infringement of a patent. It's not very easy to do because the other side employs expert witnesses who want to trash your analytical chemistry. So it, yeah. It's
so this is kind of a challenging intellectual exercise.
Yeah, it's a kind of a game in a way, expensive game.
Oh yes. Yes,
the case that was won in Canada, I won't tell you the participants, but the fine was $80 million.
Ooh.
So messing about here.
Yeah, so that proved infringement.
That improved infringement.
Okay. Well, yes, and of course legal fees.
I can't imagine what they were.
No. An interesting business. Mm. Well, one thing that's true, you know, you get into those situations that people would come out wondering, they're lawyers, they make their money.
Yeah, yes.
Anyway. And then your government interactions are pretty good, except, you know, particularly with Fred, but then I guess lately the government interactions aren't as good as they used to be.
No. And NRC is a shadow of its former self. I mean, it used to be a scientific intellectual hotbed,
mm-hmm.
and well, it's seen better days. Did you ever come across Bob Shapiro?
The name's familiar.
He was editor of OMS before me.
Okay.
I took over from Bob, mm-hmm. and Bob had done some consulting for analytical chemistry,
mm-hmm.
and I think he got involved with some very shady characters to help them shoot down the government witnesses and so on. Yeah.
Since you mentioned the magazine, you said you were the editor of
Organic Mass Spectrometry. Yes, right. Yeah, for 17 years I did that.
What did that involve?
Receiving articles, getting them reviewed, and persuading the authors to make the appropriate changes, keeping all the paperwork running. Hayden. It started with Hayden and Son,
mm-hmm.
who were a family company of publishers in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And OMS was started in 1968 mm-hmm. by Alan McColl and Gunter Hayden. By the way, I think Keith Jennings got that wrong in his spiel. But it was Gunter Hayden and Alan McColl who started the journal at the 1967 meeting in Berlin.
Okay.
It was a big mass triennial meeting, I suppose, in Berlin. And they set up OMS then. At the same time that InJ Mass Spectrum and Ion Processes was started.
Mm-hmm.
So the two journals kicked off in 68, and they had been dreamed up in 67.
Mm-hmm. And so you did have some help with doing the OMS editorial?
Yeah, I started doing that in the 70s sometime. Forgotten when now.
Did you ever come down on the side of the author if a reviewer?
The most difficult thing was finding a stable of reliable reviewers, and I would say, let's say, pretty arbitrary, let's say you took 20 names, maybe one or possibly two would be reliable. Take the time.
And get it back to you.
Because you quickly learned you sent a paper to X and he would do a bloody good job, and Y would send back and say, publisher's stance. You think, sorry, you're off my list because you've done sweet FA towards helping the journal along. I had one threatening letter. And I carried on a correspondence with Maurice Bursey. Do you know Maurice Bursey?
Yes.
Okay, I carried on a correspondence with Maurice in rhyme. It got a little out of hand because it finished by Maurice producing a sonnet in proper sonnet form to a CAD iron. So it was hugely entertaining. Most of our rhymes were Gilbert and Sullivan takeoffs. But it was great fun. I kept a file of them all.
That would be fun. You should put that together and publish it sometime.
Yes, it was. It was excellent fun.
So you were acting as editor, and he was acting as the author.
He was an author. He was an author who sent his paper in, and so you know, I said, well, you know, Maurice, this wasn't very good. This part and that part, and change this and rewrite that. And then the answer came back as a little poem. So I thought, oh, right, Maurice, you've asked for this. So I replied in rhyme, and it got worse and worse as papers came in and were reviewed. So we had a great howl over that. It was funny. And then he did to a CAD iron, and I thought, oh, Maurice. And I looked, oh, crikey, he's even got, it's proper sonnet, you know, lines 1 and 3. And, oh!
You weren't interested in having that much fun.
Oh, dear.
So you say you had a patent with, what other experiences did you have that were exciting or interesting or fun?
With the journal.
I mean, it took us some time. What was the load of papers that you would get in a
year?
Yeah, a couple hundred thousand.
In a year.
Maybe a hundred in a year.
It wasn't huge, and. I don't remember it as being burdensome because I was sufficiently familiar, I think, with most of what was written. It's not as if it was Jack's or something like that. Mm-hmm. I was sufficiently familiar that I would see right away whether the referee's comments were reasonable or unreasonable because the experiment, you know, couldn't possibly show that or whatever. And so in that sense, It wasn't too much of a burden.
So you were the arbiter of the referee's comments versus what the fellow had written.
Yeah, that's right. And, yes.
Did you ever like reject a paper just because it wasn't appropriate for that? You didn't see that it is appropriate for the journal.
Yes. Oh, yes. I don't suppose you remember this, but. In the earlier days of mass spectrometry, and certainly in the early days of OMS, a paper would come in. Charlie Brown has measured the mass spectra of 15 isomeric hooply-poops, and here's a discussion, and here's a series of fragmentation mechanisms, and another 5 pages of pure guesswork. And so I remember sitting down with Alan and saying, we've got to stop this flood of nonsense. Because the mass spectrum is interesting. The interpretation is wholly bogus. And so we opened a section which was called New Mass Spectra, which were just that. And so quite a number of papers which had no serious supporting physicochemical evidence you'd send back to the author and say, sorry. You can't sustain any of your mechanistic proposals by means of anything. This should reappear as new mass spectra. And so that was a very small section at the back, and it didn't take up much space, of course. But that was very unpopular in the beginning, because sure. people would say, gee, oh, you know, I've labored over this fragmentation mechanism. I'd say, well, I'm sorry, how can you possibly say that the iron in mm-hmm. chapter in reaction 4 is the such and such iron? Mm-hmm. It's a waste of space. You've no evidence at all. You've got to do
more experiments.
You've got to go, I mean, hey, come on, there's a PhD thesis in finding out what that is.
Yeah.
So you're just... it's just hand waving.
Yes. Well, that's unfortunate that people do that, but I guess sometimes they're hard up for a publication. Maybe they figure they can get a sneak it by. The old publisher Parrish, I guess, still pretty much in the scientific field.
Well, it was the commercial journals that started that. The first commercial journal was 1957, Tetrahedron Letters.
Okay.
I think that was the first commercial journal.
Commercial journal?
One which was published to make a profit for the publisher.
Okay.
I could be inaccurate,
as opposed to
but I'm pretty sure it was Tetrahedron Letters that started 1957.
As opposed to
a society journal.
Like American Chemical Society.
Yes, the Faraday Society, the Chemical Society, Compte Rendu de la, what's it, and all the German journals. They were all society journals, and Proceedings of the Royal Society was not intended to make them a fortune.
Yeah, and then I think lately, isn't the idea of a fee for publishing come into vogue again? Some journals.
Oh, yes, I know. Yes,
charging to publish.
Yeah.
And then they charge for the journal, and then if you download a copy on the internet, they charge.
Yes,
that's
right.
So
that's right.
It's,
so the university pays, or the library pays fees,
mm-hmm.
of course, to allow us to download from Wiley and.
Serious fees.
Yeah.
Patents. You mentioned you had a patent with Fiji, wasn't it?
Yeah. That was for measuring the radiation emitted from excited ions.
Why did you this? How did what? That seems a strange. When did you discover this?
I had a grad student who is now chair of the department here, Paul Meyer. And the idea had been around for quite a long time, and when we got the new ZAB in 82 with its box, I asked VG to put some quartz windows in it in case we wanted to shine light in. And it occurred to us that if we put a collision cell underneath the window and could arrange a monochromator on top outside the window, we could look to see if ions emitted something when they were collisionally excited. And so that problem was given to Paul, and the first experiments that we did were a visible emission, and we used gelatin in glass filters for bandpass regions, and a photocell. So it was simply a question of looking at a block spectrum of radiation, and the three compounds we chose, three ions we chose, were acetaldehyde, vinyl alcohol, oxurane.
Oh, yes.
Ethylene oxide, which were easily distinguishable by their metastable ion peaks. And the filtered radiation from the three, were quite different. So I said, let's go. So we applied for money for a grating monochromator, liquid nitrogen cooled, and all the electronic gear to go with it. And so we set up to investigate the radiation. And VG I kept them informed all the time, and they said, look, if this ever goes anywhere, could we patent it with you? So I said, yes, of course you can. Mm-hmm. So we took out a patent with them. It's probably died by now.
Yeah, well, I think it's kind of a thing. But it is. Some schools in the United States have, you know, legal departments that assist faculty with getting their patents, their ideas patented. I don't know if that's being done here.
I don't know. VG provided the legal assistance, and I made sure I could understand what it said. And we signed up, and the university, of course, carries a portion of that as well.
So what kind of, where does the light emitted photon, where do they come from?
In high energy collisions, mm-hmm. It's mostly atomic. Hmm. It's mostly atomic. You've collided the ions, which are traveling at whatever it is, so many hundred kilometers a second. Mm-hmm. You've collided them with an essentially stationary target, mm-hmm. and of course, as well as producing interesting fragment ions, mm-hmm. they are also blown to pieces. Mm-hmm. And so you see carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, whatever, emission lines. Mm-hmm. So they're mainly line spectra. Hmm. But there's a girl in the lab now. We've turned the experiment round the other way because she's doing interstellar chemistry.
Yeah, so I was going to ask you about this interstellar business.
And the idea that she's doing is the projectile is a hydrogen molecular ion of which is a pretty... on the interstellar scale, pretty common species, mm-hmm. and a molecule which is a vaporized molecule which is gently leaked into a collision cell, and so now we've got these hydrogen ions flying into a collision cell with the window, and we're looking at the emission now from the cold molecules. In their, if you like, in their interstellar mode, being struck by high-velocity hydrogen molecular ions. And the spectra are different. We have some visible spectra coming out of these. It's only, 6 weeks old, so it's early days. Mm-hmm. But it's different. It's turning the scale around. Instead of having high-velocity ions, it's of more interest to take abundant interstellar species and see what they're up to. I did an analysis for the Enceladus people. You remember the space program sent a probe with a mass spectrometer on it, mm-hmm. to planetary moons, mm-hmm. and the spectra came back with a resolution of about 120. Mm-hmm. And I've forgotten how it came about now. Anyway, they sent me all the spectra and asked my opinion, and they wanted mass 78, mm-hmm. to be benzene, mm-hmm. and it was a big 77. So yeah, that's okay, but there was a big 65. A too big 65. Mm-hmm. Benzene does lose methyl,
right.
But only a little bit. Yeah. But here there's a great big 65. So I said, well, of course it could be a phenomenon of your apparatus. Maybe it's a quadrupole system. Mm-hmm. I said, maybe an apparatus phenomenon. But I said, I don't think you can be absolutely certain that it's benzene that you are picking up in material being ejected from the surface of the moon. Mm-hmm. They've got a new probe on the way there. I've forgotten which year it arrives. and it'll have much better equipment.
It's
very entertaining to talk to these people.
So, but I mean, did you give any speculation as to what it could be, if it's not benzene, the 77 and the
65? Well, benzene's cheapest energy dissociation is loss of a hydrogen atom. Mm-hmm. In that energy manifold, before you get to the dissociation limit, there are, I've forgotten how many, at least half a dozen isomers of C6H6, which are stable as an ion. And one of them, of course, has got a methyl group in it, which is quite a big shift from poor old benzene to getting a methyl group. So there's a variety of potential neutrals, not very stable on the test tube scale, but which might play a role in this far-off place. You know, you can't just write it off and say, no, it's got to be benzene. It's not any, even though it's highly probable, but it's not proven.
Yeah, well, benzene's, of course, there's so much stuff in interstellar space that we never knew was there before. But it seems that, you know, an aromatic compound would be a little hard to jazz up.
Yes, quite a few polyaromatics have been identified in the interstellar medium now. And anyway, it's fun to see these data.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Now it seems to me, I was browsing through your CV and your papers. It seems to me that you've done all this kind of very fundamental chemistry, yeast formation, gas phase ion chemistry, pyrolysis, thermochemical. Radical studies, proton affinities, this is all kind of really fundamental stuff.
Yes, yes.
And these experiments you described, light, photon emission. So you're kind of going back to your earlier study based on photolysis, or with photons, but from a different angle than...
I think that's just the way it turned out. I don't have any grad students anymore. No. I just interact with Paul's grad students.
I see.
And they drop in for a chat every now and again.
But this whole kind of fundamentals, that seems to be common with what I, when I talked to Alex Garrison and also with Paul Cabarly. There seems to be in the Canadian sphere this very strong interest in these very basic fundamental properties of ions, is there a reason for that particular strong? I don't think it's so strong in other parts of the country.
It's not because we knew each other, because I knew Alex Harrison when I was at NRC, but he was just some guy who was working with Fred Lossing, and what Fred Lossing did was got nothing to do with my photochemistry, so I never really knew. And it wasn't until we started the Trent meetings that I saw Alex Harrison fairly regularly. The Trent meetings are undergraduate meetings.
So when you say Trent meetings...
Postgrad student meetings.
And this is a...
This is at a university in the middle of Ontario called Trent.
Okay.
And they're up to number 31 now. We've been going over 30 years.
So this is an annual?
It's an annual do, and it's a student-oriented do.
Okay. When you say student, is this graduate?
Then? Graduate students. Graduate. It's grad students. So we get about, in a good year, there's maybe 30 or 40 grad students from across Canada, all doing some sort of something related to mass spectrometry, and a few supervisors and a lake with canoes and swimming and it's nice.
So they have is this like a week long or over the weekend?
No, it's a 3 or 4 days.
And then you've got orals and posters, papers presented.
Yep.
Just general interaction.
Yep. That's right. Yes.
And, try and get the kids interested in
Well, they meet students from other places.
Yeah.
Chris Wesdemiotis used to come on a fairly regular basis. He hasn't come in recent years, but the first meeting was all conducted in the single day, which was quite an ordeal, because we would leave here at 6 o'clock in the morning, drive like hell to Peterborough.
Which is how far?
Which is Peterborough, 150 miles.
A couple hours, for sure.
So it's a two-lane highway. So it,
4 hours.
So, and there'd be a morning talks, lunch, afternoon talks, dinner, and we'd get back home here about 2 o'clock in the morning.
Oh,
it
wow.
was, but the students loved it. It was, mm-hmm. It was quite a giggle for them.
So it was really focused on them more than
yes,
the
yes, yes, yes.
Any,
yes.
Did you have like big guns come in and give a plenary or overall?
No, 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 no. Every now and again, one of us would give a talk about something.
Mm-hmm.
I think I gave one the year I retired or mm-hmm. something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But the meeting is now a 3-day thing. We've it's overnight lodgings and mm-hmm. and all the rest.
And whose brainchild was this?
I think that Alex and I started it. Ray March at Trent will claim that it was his, but Trent was very convenient because it was equidistant.
Mm-hmm.
But. It doesn't really matter. It was all started at the same time,
mm-hmm.
and it's been very successful.
Do you have a registration fee for this? Or is it cost?
Oh, no. Where do we get them? Wait a minute. Yes, OMS used to give us money in the good old days. Gunter Hayden would chip in. And where do we get the money from? VG gave us $1,000.
Okay.
It's pretty well supported from outside.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it costs the grad students much more than maybe some beer and a snack on the way to or from.
Okay. It sounds like
it's subsidized.
Okay. That sounds good. Well, that's it seems like an interesting, I don't think there's anything like that in the States.
No, Chris used to say, I remember when Chris regularly came and said, I wish we had something like this in the States, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. this is the grad students all get to chat, know one another.
And, yeah, that's good.
Mm-hmm.
Important. Let's see, I've got a number of people with whom you've published a lot of work, and we talked about several of them. There's a fellow by the name of Peter Burgers. Did we talk about Peter Burgers at all?
Peter was a grad student of Hans Tallau.
Ah, okay.
And then he became a postdoc with me.
Mm-hmm.
And Peter is a one of a kind person. He would. What can I say? I guess I'd say he's a rather gentle soul. And he'd never make an academic. but he's extremely intelligent and
mm-hmm.
full of ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And he works in a medical institute in the Netherlands now
mm-hmm.
as their spectroscopist for you name it.
Mm-hmm.
You name it.
Mm-hmm.
But he's an ideas guy, Peter Burgers. He's great. Very tall, ginger.
Mm-hmm. We've talked about Mummers. His name's actually Alexander, but he
went
by
Sander. Sander.
Okay.
He's a technical whiz.
Mm-hmm.
He really is. He's in huge demand in Canada because these people don't exist anymore.
Uh-huh.
He can fix anybody's instrument.
Mm-hmm.
He also buys and sells them.
Oh, wow.
He has his own company. And so he was away all last week, somewhere in Western Ontario, installing a concept, I think.
Oh, okay.
Government lab.
Zagorevsky?
Dmitry.
Mm-hmm.
Dmitry Zagorevsky is a wild Russian gent. Extremely hardworking, Dmitry.
Mm-hmm.
He's somewhere in the States. We lost touch.
Mm.
Good scientist, Dmitry.
There's a person named Hop here.
Marcel Hop. Marcel Hop, Dutchman. He did his experimental work in my lab and got his Dutch PhD. That was one of the pictures was him at his graduation.
Oh, yes.
At his viva.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
His oral exam and so on.
Okay. Aubrey?
Christiane Aubry. I still work with Christiane.
Oh.
She was a graduate student. We're still publishing together.
Hmm.
We write about energetics and correlation schemes.
Okay.
And what's the driving force? The driving force is A, it's amusing and interesting, and B, did you know Sharon Lias?
Yes.
Okay, well, when Sharon died, there was a terrible gap, and because Peter Ausluse had retired, and there was a kind of a hole at NIST, and some years after Sharon had died, NIST got in touch with me and said, would I or a colleague be prepared to help in data collecting?
Mm-hmm.
And so Christiane and I took a contract with NIST for updating the data.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how many hundred data items we co-collected over 2 or 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
But they were all sent off to NIST, and I went down there and talked to them. And then Bush happened, and the funding went. And if you go on NIST now and you look for the data which we had sent down 4 years ago, 5 years ago, hasn't got through yet. Hasn't got through yet. So until they get properly funded and can hire... let's say 2 well-informed young scientists who can update the whole damn thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a shame because it's the only show in the world.
Yeah. Ah. Yeah. It's just something that's deep.
Yes, you know, Stand Up America.
Yeah. Well, we don't want to go there. Paul Mayer. Mayer?
Paul's chairman here.
Okay, it's Mayer.
He's the student who did the emission. Who started the emission work with me, and so he's in charge of the lab now. They're all his grad students there.
So you say he's the chair of the
chemistry department.
So
yes, he's got
stayed on here.
He's got all the ills that.
Poor guy.
Yes, poor guy. Yes, I know. You need a very thick skin.
Yeah,
and. It means your interaction time with the students
goes way down.
Is terribly reduced.
Yeah, definitely. So, let's see, we got Benoit, B-N-O-I-T.
Frank Benoit. Frank Benoit was my first mass spec grad student. He was the maleic, fumaric, and other carboxylic acids guy.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
He worked for the Canadian government. He went to work with Health Canada, I think.
Okay.
As an analyst.
Cao, CAO.
Oh, G. Ah, G is in China. Sheila and I are honorary grandparents.
Oh, there you go.
when I went to China, I was met at Beijing Airport. I was told I'd be met at Beijing Airport because I had 6 hours before the flight on to Changchun, and I would be met. So here is G, as a charming young lady waiting to meet me, good English, and I've discovered quickly that she was a chemistry student, and what would I like to do? So I said, well, I didn't care much for the meal on Canadian Pacific. What I'd really like is to have a Beijing duck.
Mm-hmm.
So she fell about laughing and said, come along, come along. So we went and we had a splendid meal, and she popped me on the plane, and away I went to Changchun.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in Changchun for 3 or 4 weeks giving talks and so on. Anyway, and I met another fellow there who came here as a postdoc. When I got back to Beijing, there was an international conference that I was to be at. So I was in Beijing for another 10 days or so. And G was my guide. It was my personal guide.
How do you spell?
G, J-I-E. G, Cao.
Mm-hmm.
And G said, can I come and be a grad student? So I said, yeah, no problem, get the paperwork done, you're in. Mm-hmm. So G came here and did her PhD, and after a lot of umming and ahhing, she went home. Mm-hmm. She went back to China, she got a university job, she married, I think, her high school sweetheart, mm-hmm. and they have a little boy called Tong Tong. And so we get, we exchange birthday cards with Tong Tong. Mm-hmm. And he calls us his honorary grandparents, which is nice.
It's interesting how a random relationship turns.
Yes, yes, that's right.
George, M. George.
Oh, George is from India. He's, I'm sorry, I've forgotten his university in India, but... he keeps in touch from time to time because he's still doing chemistry there. Mm-hmm. In the subcontinent, the tendency is to rise in the administrative stream if possible, mm-hmm. and not have to do nasty things like work in a lab, mm-hmm. and that's like Africa as well. Mm-hmm. And so, but George is an experimentalist. He's great. He comes to ASMS. Yep. Every now and again, he gets the funding to come. Yeah.
What's his first name?
Oh, dear.
There's an M George. Here.
Oh, we always called him George. Oh, it's probably, you know, Mohammed or sorry, I've forgotten what his initial stands for.
Mike Gross had a relationship with an Indian fellow that was similar to that. He would come to work in Mike's lab for, you know, 3 or 4 weeks in the summer or whatever, and then go back to India, and it sounds like a similar kind of a thing. Then there's this, I guess, Hungarian fellow, Bordas Nagy.
Oh, yes, Joseph. Joseph Bordas Nagy, he's very clever. Mm-hmm. He's Polish. Mm-hmm. Very, very clever student indeed. Mm-hmm. He was very quiet, rather withdrawn, and good-humoured and full of ideas. Mm-hmm. He did a lot of stuff with the Rydberg species.
Ah, very good.
And he did experiments where we use metal vapours to interact with the iron beam.
Yeah, I saw some of these publications in here that were metal, rhodium.
Oh, those were organometallics with Dimitri.
Oh, okay. But he was doing a different metal species interaction.
Well, he was introducing metal vapor into the iron beam. Dimitri was interested in organometallics, uh-huh. where the mass spectrometry was a terrible mess.
You bet.
And so so a lot of what he did put the house in order. Uh-huh, uh-huh. So it was, yes.
So how did he decide what metal he wanted to use in this collision software? He was just looking for the heaviest thing.
Joseph? We looked up volatility. Mm-hmm. And so after sodium, potassium, and cesium, we then switched to cadmium. We didn't do mercury. Cadmium, magnesium. And AN other, I can't remember now. But any metal which had a reasonable vapor pressure at about 600 centigrade was fair game, mm-hmm. to put in the little cell.
That's pretty warm.
Yeah. Yes, that's why we could get magnesium out.
So, and you were sitting opposite that with a cold
liquid nitrogen cold finger, yes.
So these guys, you were heating them to blazes.
That's right, and they were just whipping across, and the iron beam was... coming through.
Okay, I guess that works.
No, it did work very well. Yes.
You had, I guess, what I call competitors in the business with the guys like Kibarli and Harrison.
Paul Kibarl, I never interacted with because he was essentially interested in proton affinities.
Okay.
And our interest in proton affinities came up as a side issue with what was the so-called kinetic method for measuring proton affinities,
okay.
which is a method which works in limited circumstances, but it's a good method when it works. Mm-hmm. And Alex Harrison, I simply knew because he was around, mm-hmm. and because we always met at least at Trent, mm-hmm. and but we never collaborated in anything.
And nor did you consider him to be a competitor in the
kind of thing? No. We didn't.
Were there any Americans or Europeans that were competitors, you would say, or did you end up collaborating with everyone?
Competitors. Fred McLafferty got upset with me once.
He's gotten upset with everyone.
Yeah, well, we had we were looking at dystonic ions, mm-hmm. and the ion of interest was CH2ClH. It's methyl chloride, but it's CH2ClH, and as an ion, it's more stable than. It's more stable than ionized methyl chloride.
Uh-huh.
And Fred and Chris Westermiotis claimed that they had produced stable neutral CH2Cl. And we differed for a variety of really very good reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was peripheral to something that Hans and I were doing. So we included it in the paper we feel that Westermiotis and McLafferty are wrong in this regard because, and Fred got very upset and he phoned me about it and said, was I, you know, after him or something? So I said, well, I'm sorry you were upset, Fred. There was no intention to wound or injure you in any way. It's just the way the chips fell. And I said, if you prove something that I've done is wrong, that's fine by me. That's the way science goes. And so we sort of had a little friction.
Mm-hmm.
But I like Fred. He's a nice guy.
Yeah.
And he ran one hell of a group there.
Definitely. So I guess most of the people that you did have outside of your own lab, where you ended up being, it seems like you ended up working out a collaborative arrangement as much as possible, rather than getting into competitive
The only other person I can think of who was competitive, but that was probably his entire name. That's Helmut Schwarz.
Hmm.
Have you met Helmut?
I'm sure I have.
Well, Helmut, I think, is an administrator of some kind now. He's in some heavy scientific governmental thingy.
Mm-hmm.
But Helmut was hugely energetic and very competitive.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess we probably disagreed on a number of occasions, but say la vie, mm-hmm. it's not really very important, mm-hmm. but immensely hard working. A very nice experiment that Helmut did was with C60. C60.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know that you can trap things in a cage?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, the experiment that first, the real experiment that showed that was true, was to take C60 ions, pass them through helium as a collision gas, and to your astonishment, C60 plus 4 came out the other end, and Dieter Bohmer at Toronto was with him and did the experiment. I thought that's really pretty nice experiment.
Mm-hmm.
You've blown your helium into the cage and it's stuck in there.
Mm-hmm.
And they could neutralize it as well. And so here you have C60 with a helium atom bouncing about inside.
Yes, the individual complex. Yeah, that's kind of interesting thing about
C60. I'll tell you a little story about Helmut Schwarz, which was great fun. At one of the NATO meetings, Helmut was giving one of his plenary-type lectures. Helmut is very expansive on the podium. And always half through his lecture, because he thinks Berlin is a wonderful city, he would say, now I'm going to take a break and I will tell you just for a few minutes the wonderful things we have in Berlin. And so up comes slides, you see, and there's all these superb things in galleries and museums and so on. And that wonderful head of Nefertiti came up, and Tutankhamun, bits and pieces. And so Helmut got near the end of his exposition, and we were all sitting there. And way up in the back of the auditorium, a British voice came down. It said, "Hey, Helmut, how did they get there?" And of course, the place collapsed with laughter. And Helmut, after a moment, shot, laughed as well, because he could see the funny side of it. But of course, most of them had got there by means we don't speak about anymore. But it was a sort of classical moment. Helmut, how did they get there?
Oh, wait, that was a brave soul. I wonder who that was.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, the great thing was that it didn't offend Helmut.
Oh boy. Interesting. I was wondering if we could maybe trace a little bit your educational ancestors. You got your PhD working under
Alan McCall.
And then do you recall what who his advisor was?
Yes, his advisor was. I met him.
Mm-hmm.
He was a prof at Armidale University in New South Wales. I'm sorry, his name is not in the memory banks.
Okay, well maybe you can.
I can find out. But he was his prof in Australia.
Ah, in Australia.
Alan was born in Scotland and went to Australia as a baby.
Oh.
And so he grew up in Australia.
Hmm. You're a Canadian citizen?
I am now, yes.
Okay, yep. So you went ahead and took the Canadian citizen. Is that the old rule with the UK, or did you give up the UK? Or can you?
No, I can keep. I've got both.
Okay,
I keep
I'm
both.
Curious about
yeah.
that. Because there has been this fellow Dempster, the Dempster mass spec.
Yes.
He was a Canadian.
Oh, yes, so he was.
Ended,
yes.
Ended up taking American citizenship.
Yeah.
For reasons which I never quite
understood. Yes,
sure.
Yeah.
But, he was sort of...
Yeah. Yes.
So I was wondering, it would be interesting as far back as we could to trace the academic parentage back.
Yeah, that was something that Keith Laidler did. In his history of physical chemistry, mm-hmm. he's got some family scientific trees.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it silly? I can see the guy as clear as anything. What was his name?
Well, if you think of it, you can email me or ask Alan. So what do you consider to be your most significant publication? Plural or singular?
Oh. It's not something that I can answer, but I can tell you those that were the most fun.
Okay.
Which is not the same at all, I hope. the work I did with Hans Tolau on metastable ions, that was very exciting for us.
Mm-hmm.
That was for the identification of the isomers of C2H4O,
mm-hmm.
simply by the virtue of their peak shapes.
Mm-hmm.
And you could do a follow-on from that. We did a little follow-on and showed that isopropanol, when it lost methane... isopropanol, when it lost methane, mm-hmm. as an ion, it produced a mixture of vinyl alcohol and acetaldehyde ions, and so the peak came out with an extremely broad component, and superimposed upon it the narrow spike of acetaldehyde. Mm-hmm. And if you do a deuterium labeling study, you can separate those two guys out. So it was, you know, so
yeah.
pretty it worked nicely.
Pretty nice.
The emission with Paul was very exciting, because it had never been done before, at least not as far as we knew.
Mm-hmm.
The dystonic ions, the thing with radon, finding that making CH2OH2
mm-hmm.
ions,
mm-hmm.
the first real dystonic ion,
mm-hmm.
and then of course renaming all the ion dipole complexes. In their right way, they're all dystonic ions, and
mm-hmm.
so as soon as you've created that network, it spreads out like that, and you think, my God, this kind of ion is everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the things I did with Fred, when we showed that the enol ions were all thermodynamically more stable than their keto counterpart, that's an exact reversal of neutral chemistry.
Mm.
Because keto is more stable than enol for the neutral, and enol is the stable iron form.
Mm.
And so that works everywhere. That's why part of the reason why phenol is stable. The keto analog is thermodynamically close, but it just manages there.
Mm.
But all the others, acetaldehyde and vinyl alcohol and acetone and its enol, they're difficult to make as neutrals, and they're unstable anyway. I don't know. It's most of it has been jolly entertaining, and if it seemed like a good idea and it was worth following up, that was a huge pleasure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's difficult to pick anything out because we used to call them mini Eureka moments.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Yeah.
One was when I went to Holland, I stopped off in Swansea to see John Bynum.
Okay.
And they were doing experiments with argon. They were doing mass spectrometry of argon ion beams.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking to the chap there, and he was describing how efficient the charge exchange is between argon iron and argon neutral.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, we don't need to worry in Holland about trying to make a mercury neutralization source,
mm-hmm.
a cell like Fred McLafferty, mm-hmm. because mercury in a mass spectrometer is not a good idea.
Right.
I said, we should use xenon. And as soon as I arrived off the plane, I said, Hans, have we got a cylinder of xenon anywhere in the university?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, we'll find one. And yeah, xenon is it's great,
sure.
Perfect for that experiment.
Yeah,
so it's...
Well, I was looking at your publication. One of the most highly cited publications was Assigning Structure Science in the Gas Phase. That was published in 85.
Mm-hmm. That was a review.
Yeah. Okay, so that gets you a lot of citations. Heats of formation of oxygen containing organic free radicals from appearance energy measurements.
Oh, that was a fun thing with Fred, because in many dissociations, you get a stable ion and an interesting free radical. And if the process takes place at a carefully measured energy, and you know the heat of formation of the starter and the ion, the missing datum is the heat of formation of the neutral.
Mm.
And so it was a backdoor method for measuring heats of formation of free radicals.
Oh, wow.
And that was fun.
Yeah. Fun seems to be the operative word.
Yeah. I picked out one thing for you.
Oh, okay.
Which is off the beaten track.
Okay, I think I've seen this title.
Peter Derrick asked me to write something,
mm-hmm.
about mass spectrometry.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, I'm not going to write a review article, I'm going to write about that. And he said, yeah, go for it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's what it's about.
It
was an opportunity, you see, to write about science in a way that a commercial journal does not normally pursue.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, very good. Well, thank you for this. I'll add that to my reading in the process, and we'll make that part of the record. Mm. There's also this paper that I think you published that was about the lecture that you gave about your garden of science, or the garden of...
Oh, cultivating my chemical garden.
Yeah, cultivating your...
My chemical garden. That was a university research award lecture.
Mm-hmm.
So...
It sounds like an intriguing kind of a...
The purpose was to show that... I think that the purpose was to show that the best science you do is what you want to do and not what you're told to do. So that if you are in an environment where you're controlled, you do this today and you do that tomorrow, I don't give a shit about that, ignore that. That's not the way to do science. The way to do it is to just let it spread, as a lot of them will be dead ends, but that doesn't matter, that's par for the course. But if you don't let the ideas fan out, you're never going to get anywhere. You're just going to get routine facts piled up. And so I tried to make out the idea. I gave a public lecture, in fact gave two in West Africa, because I went to Ghana as a visiting prof to teach. And
how long were you there?
6 months.
Oh, wow.
That was in 1970-ish. And it was a Nuffield award, and what came with it was the duty of giving two public lectures in two cities. So I gave one in Accra, the capital, which ACCRA, and that was fine because I guess about 100 people, black and white, all came and questions. It was a very general layman's lecture, if you like. And then I had to go to Cape Coast. Cape Coast is the place where the slave trade used to leave from. And they built a university at Cape Coast, which is very beautiful, a wonderful campus, just like in Accra. And I said, may I drive myself? I don't really want to have a driver. I'd like to go under my own steam. Well, yes, all right. So I had a car and I drove up to Cape Coast and arrived at the university and marched up to the wicket and said, I've come here to give a public lecture. Nobody knew who I was and what I was about, so I was telephoning. And I was duly hustled off to a bungalow. And then and it was just about getting dark. And a couple of fellows arrived and said, this hasn't been very well publicised. Will you come along to the auditorium, please? And I decided afterwards that this is an experience which every university prof should have to undergo. Anyway, they wheeled me into this auditorium, which seated 600. And there were five people in the front row. So I was a bit pissed off. So I said, geez, I've driven a long way. And this sort of all went pear-shaped, didn't it? they were nice enough people, some black, some white. And I said, do you want me to go ahead with this? And they said, well, you've come all this way. But it is. So let's go. So I gave my talk to this huge audience. And then I remembered, and I said, well, come on, I believe the refrigerator in my bungalow is stuffed with beer. Let's go and check it out. And it was. And so we went back and drank a very large quantity of beer with the whole audience, yes. But I'm giving a public lecture to an audience of five, I think that's something everybody should have to undergo. It's a bit of a shock, because the one in Accra was great, because it wasn't a very big auditorium, and so it was maybe half to two-thirds full. Where is everybody?
That's got to be a little. At least they can do is find a smaller room.
Yes. It was a beautiful auditorium, plush tip-up seats.
So you mentioned NATO. There seems to be a theme running through some of these interviews that people get involved in NATO activities with the science.
The NATO scientific meetings were really excellent. You know the rule. They have to be in a remote place.
Okay.
And so one was at this nunnery in the Vosges Mountains. The one that Henry Rosenstock died at, was on the Portuguese coast. Another one was at Les Arcs, a ski resort out of season in the French Alps. Where was the next one? There was one in Holland, in a tiny little town on the coast. And I think I only went to four.
So
but they were very, very good. They were like workshops, if you like.
So who came to these? I mean, they were locals, or were they supposed to be?
It was known that these things happened, and how were they supported? You applied to go. My recollection is that an advertisement was known about.
Mm-hmm.
And a friend or a colleague would say, "Hey, look, there's a gas phase ion chemistry NATO meeting in Portugal." And so you read about it and see who might be going, and so you sign up, and away you go to Portugal, and there's a couple of hundred people there.
So this would be, you get a chance to interact with your colleagues, but then you'd also be able to explain your science to an audience of other people.
No, it's all in a field.
Ah.
So they'd all be gas phase ion chemistry mass spec people.
Okay.
Yes.
But the audience would be interested in learning or knowing more about your work.
We'll all be swapping information about what we did.
Okay. It's not like a Gordon conference.
Though. It's like a Gordon conference. Yeah. Exactly like a Gordon conference. Yes, that's right.
Okay. And so you could sign up for these and
yeah, and go. Yes, they were excellent. Oh, there was one in Israel, of course. There was one in Israel as well.
But the NATO requirement was they had to be in an out-of-the-way place.
They had to be in a remote spot, and which was a good idea.
Yeah.
It meant there were no flesh pots to steal you away, and so they were very good. The one in the Vosges was in the middle of hiking country.
Mm-hmm.
The one in Portugal had beaches, tennis courts, nobody else there, and trips. They gave us trips. They're always coach trips to somewhere or other, and a guide. I'll tell you a quick short story. At the Portuguese meeting, the organizer, a Portuguese lady, stood up one morning and said, "This morning, I have to tell you, we would like some of you to take the afternoon off. We have an invitation from the mayor of Torres Viedras." Torres Viedras is famous in Napoleonic and Wellington Peninsula war times. Anyway, the mayor would like to meet these scientists. So any of you who would volunteer to go, the coach will be outside at 1 o'clock. So, you know, everybody looked at everybody and thought, "Oh, God, do we really want to go and meet the mayor of Torres Viedras and have some awful spiel and so on?" So anyway, some of us got together and said, "Look, some of us have got to go. Otherwise, poor Maria will be awfully embarrassed." So maybe 30 or more of us volunteered and climbed on the bus. And off it went into the hills and down into this little town. And it went along a street which was just wide enough to accommodate the bus. Everybody out. And we went into this building. And when we got to the top of the stairs, we went into what looked like a classroom with a stage and a lectern. So, this is strange. And the walls were all panelled with wood. So we all sat down and nothing much happened. And then a little gentleman came on, and it was the mayor of Torres Viedras.
Mm-hmm.
His English was perfect and his humour was wonderful. So before long, he had us all in fits of laughter. So we thought, "This is great, this is heap, what a nice guy. What's going to happen after this?" At the end of his lecture, he waved his arms, he said, "And now, more entertainment." And the walls were folded back, and in the room behind the walls were tables and bottles and young ladies, all spoke English. So we had a whale of a time. It was a huge quantity of food, plenty to drink. and very pleasant young Portuguese ladies to talk to. So when we got off the coach at the end of the day, everybody we saw, you missed out by not coming. But it was so unexpected. Yeah. We thought it might be, you know, formal, and it wasn't. It was terrific.
So what did the mayor have to say?
He told a history. He told us a hilarious history of the town, and what Wellington did, what Napoleon did, and who said what, and what happened when, and it was all in a humorous way. It was great.
Oh, a good experience. So the guys that decided to take the bait end up winning.
That's right. Yes.
Had a fun day.
Yes.
I guess the countryside is probably pretty.
Yes.
Yes. It's an interesting kind of a sliver of land there on the coast of Spain. That's an interesting way of trying to stay in existence, I imagine. I'm sure Spain would love to.
Yes. Yes. We went on a boat trip as well to some islands offshore, and I got up on the harbour wall and looked out, and I saw the Atlantic was quite vigorous. Mm-hmm. So when we got on this quite small motorboat, which would only accommodate all of us, I made sure I stayed on deck, mm-hmm. because those who were down below were quickly calling for seasick buckets, mm-hmm. and so it was a very green lot who got off at the island. Mm-hmm. It's not a success.
Mm.
Well.
There's a couple of things that I want to cover. I don't know if you want to take a break for
a while. Gosh, it's 4 o'clock already.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Well, it is four. Let me tell you what my plan was.
Yes.
I would like to spend some time talking about your interest in sailing. Mm-hmm. Which I think mm-hmm. is really an interesting mm-hmm. part of your life, and then an important message for the future and vitality of chemical research and development. And then I noticed a recent news article about Canada investigates scientists muzzling. There's some issues going on here where some scientific work is being put down by the government. Constrained by the government. I want to talk about what you knew about that.
It falls under the heading of pollution, preservation of species, global warming, mm-hmm. and some medical pharmaceutical matters.
Mm-hmm.
My son works for the government, and I brought him home a big cutting from one of the Brit daily papers, which was discussing this problem in Canada. And he said, wow, yes, on the notice board.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a problem. It means that people in senior positions in government laboratories may not make a statement about anything without clearing it with the politicians. Mm-hmm. And that's... Not a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
Not a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's bad enough that global warming is considered a non-issue.
Mm-hmm.
That's because of the tar sands. You're not supposed to call them the tar sands. You'll notice that they're the oil sands.
Uh-huh.
Now. But they were the tar sands, and tar is what they bloody well are.
Mm-hmm.
And so the amount of energy that's used to win oil from this mush is huge.
Mm-hmm.
And it all goes up the chimney as mm-hmm. CO2.
Mm-hmm.
But in my years in Canada, the climate has obviously changed.
Mm-hmm.
Self-evidently.
Mm-hmm.
And the permafrost is inching further north all the time. Oh, if by some very weird chance it's nothing to do with man's operation, that's fine. But it is. But if it is, and I'm fairly convinced that it is, and we do sweet FA about it, then I'm afraid the grandchildren and the great-grandchildren are in for a pretty awful time.
Mm-hmm.
Because when things get bad, those without will arm themselves to the teeth.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and it'll all go to hell in a handbasket. Where my stepdaughter lives on the coast of Kent, she was saying they've just been flooded.
Oh, really?
They just had a high tide. Well, the high tide comes over the seawall, and it filled their back conservatory with water. And that doesn't happen too often, but it looks as if it may be more frequent. And the Thames Barrier, you've seen the Thames Barrier, that is barely sufficient now.
Well, it's an issue that's so highly politicized.
Yeah, that's right, that's right.
I don't know. It's unfortunate that...
Well, it'll have to get worse before anything's
done.
Well,
unfortunately, the worse it gets, the less likely it's going to be that there'll ever be a chance to get better. I mean, I think people are saying we're getting close to a tipping point, and once you get to the worst...
Yes, I know. Once it's whether the tipping point is accurately identified or not, it doesn't really matter. By the time that whole areas of coastal continental regions are under 3 feet of water, then it's a bit late. And of course, the acidification of the sea is the most obvious irreversible effect. The disappearance of the coral reefs.
Well, it would be interesting if... I've always wondered if you could get at least the antis, or the people who don't subscribe to climate change, to at least agree to the fact that the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is increasing. Now, if you can't get them to admit that fact, then there's no rational way to go forward from there. But I mean, I think it's been very well shown that they...
Oh, yes, it's extremely well known. Yeah. Yes. Oh, yeah. My friend Ken in England used to work for the atomic energy people. He worked at Seascale, where they did all the uranium refining and so on. And apart from monitoring everything else that came out of their stacks, they too were concerned about the CO2 levels in the atmosphere. And so Ken had a running record of this. And it's over 400 parts per million now. And that's irrefutably over 400. And it's not so long ago that it was down at 350. So sorry, but... I don't know.
Well, the world community doesn't seem to be able to move forward. The United States is not exactly being an honorary citizen in that regard.
No, they wouldn't politics. Sign on to Kyoto.
Yeah, the politics are I don't know.
It's in a way, it's the weakness of democracy, because if you can persuade a lot of the people an untruth, it doesn't really matter. They will vote even though they don't know it's untrue. They'll be persuaded that it is so. I suppose it's always been thus. But the issues are a little more important than whether we should eat pork on Fridays or something.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I see a certain amount of Orwellian reality here, except it's not the... It's the other side of the political spectrum who's being Orwellian, which is kind of an interesting quote from.
Okay. Yes, you mean double speak.
Yes.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
And, you know, if you say it long enough,
yes. People will tend to believe it.
Yeah. Huh? So, what is important for the future vitality of chemical research and development? What's your message to the future for science and research and development?
Let them do what they want to do.
How are you going to fund them?
Generously.
Okay. Well, that's not going to happen, I'm afraid.
No, of course it isn't. We've had that. We had that in the... We had that. I grew up in it. When I went to university college, obviously science could do no wrong, and the funding was there if you knew how to ask for it. When I came to North America, I could get money from the US Air Force because they thought free radicals might have some vague importance with the future of aviation? I don't know. Mm-hmm. But you could get money from the US Air Force to support photochemistry. Mm-hmm. And so on and so on and so on. And the original NSERT grants were meant to be exploratory grants. Mm-hmm. Do what you like. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't turn out very well, we'll probably get another chance. If it doesn't turn out very well again, you're likely to fall off the wagon. Mm-hmm. But if you find anything and run with it, mm-hmm. we'll support you. Mm-hmm. But now there was talk about end products and commercial spin-off. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry, we would be nowhere if we waited for commercial spin-off. Mm. At all.
Well, I was impressed coming through, we don't want to get too involved in my travels recently, but I was at O'Hare Airport. Mm. So the development of aviation is in a huge commercial impact. It is huge facility.
Yes, yeah.
People from all over the world,
yeah,
literally.
Yeah.
Hundreds of airplanes.
Yeah.
Mm. People buying food, buying yeah, goods, yeah.
Yes. Yeah,
all because of the commercial development of getting this airplane from here.
Yes,
you know how who would have ever come to see the commercial worth of the Wright brothers trying or any?
Yes, to get a thing to fly. Yeah.
So,
yes,
The short-sightedness that has come with the what I call the MBA mentality. Is really, I think it's going to do us in. And they just don't, there's no understanding of the fact that you just don't legislate the production of creation, new science.
No, you can't. You can't do that. You can make a better mousetrap any day.
Right.
But a new idea, let people mess about in their labs. If they're any good and they spot something, you never know what it might be. I remember you've seen all the fuss about graphene.
Mm-hmm.
I mean that was a complete shot in the dark.
Mm-hmm.
I've forgotten the exact description of their original production of graphene, but it involved sticky tape.
Mm-hmm.
And arbitrary materials. It was not intended to find a monomolecular layer of interlocked benzene rings. It was, if you like, what the hell is this stuff?
Mm-hmm.
No.
Well, unfortunately, the mentality has shifted from what it was at the end of World War II. So
it's gone a long way.
So yeah. I'm not sure if it will ever come back. But at any rate, I think I've gotten at least a sense of your feelings on this subject of the future of science and chemical research and development.
It's not easy because when I was on the committee, our feelings then were that research proposals are not really a much good because they just indicate what you think you might do. Far more important is what have you done in the last granting period?
Mm.
Where's the originality? In other words, track record was what we felt was important.
Mm-hmm.
Give a guy a start, give him a reasonable length of time, 2 granting periods, 6 years,
mm-hmm.
see what he's done.
Mm-hmm.
He either remains the same or goes down or shoots up.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, now all the pressure is on, oh, we don't care about track record. No, we don't care what he's published. What's his research proposal?
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't work like that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what they like to see.
Well, can we take a little bit of time, unless you have any other things you want to talk about in terms of your scientific career, this would be a good time.
Mm.
But I know that you have expressed an interest in sailing, I'd like to explore that with you a little bit because I think it's an interesting...
Oh, when I was a child, I was going to go in the Navy.
Ah. Okay.
When I was a little boy, I was going to go.
Was this your decision or your parents' decision?
No, no, it was me. I wanted. I liked the idea of being on ships and so on, and it looked. And I have a child's diary in which, you know, choice of career. I've got a big ring around Navy. But the World War II suggested to me that the military life was not very useful, except it's not much of a life. But I wanted to go on the sea, and how can I put it? A bicycle was cheap, and you could travel all over Europe.
Mm-hmm.
To sail around Europe involves a huge capital outlay for starters, and a lot of experience and so on. So when I was at University College, we used to go, you won't know this place, it's called the Norfolk Broads. It's a series of lakes and rivers in Norfolk, in eastern England, where you can rent sailboats. And we used to go on the Norfolk Broads as a group from college, in the spring and in the autumn. It was a week's jolly on the Norfolk Broads. And I learned to sail dinghies at the University Sailing Club, which was on a lake in North London, in industrial North London.
Oh, what?
Yeah. Anyway, my friend John, who currently lives in Ottawa, we said we really ought to go to sea. We should extend our experience. And so we chartered a little boat on the east coast of England, and for the first time we went out on the Briny.
Oh, wow.
And that was great. And the following year we chartered a much larger boat from the east coast of England, and we sailed a great deal further up the east coast and round and back again. And in the summer, before I came to Canada, we chartered a boat out of Copenhagen.
Okay.
And that was a beautiful yacht built in 1924, very old-fashioned, very wet, very fast, and it slept six. And we covered the whole of the Kattegat and the Skagerrak and down through the islands and back to Copenhagen. Then I came to Canada. And of course, there were like people at NRC, so I said, listen, let's do a charter in the States next summer. So we chartered a boat out of City Island, New York. The boat was called Roe Boat, R-O-E boat, and it belonged to Jim Roe. Anyway, Jim Roe raced this boat. It was an offshore racing boat, about 38, 40 feet overall. And it was a yawl, so it had two masts, and he was quite nervous about letting the boat go to all these youngsters, but we had our affidavits from charter companies which said we were okay, we hadn't sunk anything yet, and so he said, okay, you can take her up the coast, and he said, we'll meet you in New London. And so we took off for 2 weeks up the east coast of the States and found out how foggy it gets. This was June. And we handed the boat over to Jim. And
Roe.
Jim Roe. And when I came back to England, I had saved enough money to buy a small cruiser. And so we bought a small cruiser in Edinburgh. And sailed, I don't know, maybe a third of the way around the British Isles in her in two summers. And I sold her to a New Zealander who, with his wife, were intending to return to New Zealand. And they got as far as the West Indies, and the wife discovered she was pregnant. She was sold then to a journalist who sailed her back to the UK. And it was such a fast passage, it made a little column in the Times. He sold her on. The boat was built in 1934 of wood, to a classic design. She still exists. She still floats down in near Southampton, and I know the current owner. So anyway, so that was a lot of sea and small ocean sailing. When I came back to Canada, there wasn't anywhere, there's only all this freshwater muck, and there was no sea, and so I decided I'd try competitive sailing.
Oh, wow.
So I started racing keelboats out the west end of the city here, Britannia Yacht Club, and became quite good at it, quite enthusiastic. So we would spend a lot of time training crew and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were able to go to national championships and things. With a keelboat now weighs about a ton.
Mm.
And and my daughter became interested in sailing, and my son too. My son was a good competitive sailor. And when my daughter married, she and her husband decided when they had their first child that before everything got too expensive, they'd get a cruising yacht
mm-hmm.
and think about what to do. And they bought a 50-foot steel cutter from the Madeleine Islands that belonged to a Frenchman, built in Australia, of steel. Frenchman had sailed around the world, sold her in the Madeleine Islands. That's a little group of islands in the mouth of the St. Lawrence.
Mm.
Anyway, so Dan bought her there, and I worked her back to Georgian Bay, up the St. Lawrence, with a group of old college friends.
Mm.
So I was very familiar with the boat. So we sailed her from the Madeleine Islands right up to Georgian Bay, to Midland on Georgian Bay. And then Susan and Dan had the three girls by then, and they said, we think we're going to take a year off on the boat and take the girls. So I said, oh, can I do the transatlantic with you? Yes, come on. So I sailed across the Atlantic with them in 2000 and...
Oh, not that long ago.
Not that long ago, 2005, 2006, something like that. And in the meantime, another occupation, I became an international judge.
Mm.
Do you know, I'll be very brief, you know how sailboat racing works? If you're racing and you believe you have been fouled or interfered with, or another boat has done an illegal act, you raise a little red flag.
Mm-hmm.
And when you come ashore, you lodge a protest in writing.
Mm-hmm.
And a little court sits with usually a minimum of three judges, and evidence is given like it's a little trial. And you have models, and they explain what they believe happened. And on the basis of your knowledge of the rules and your knowledge of sailors, you come to a conclusion. And either there is no penalty, or one, or sometimes both are disqualified.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way the system works. It's quite hard-nosed, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of all or nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting in its own right. Not least because it's a picture of human nature. You have these two adversarial guys trying to make their story stick.
Mm-hmm.
And they have their crew come in, and they have to sit at the back, and the crew tell their version, and they can be cross-examined and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very interesting, and so I became an international judge.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to travel around to world championships in Europe and the States, and that was interesting because of the the extraordinary people that you met.
Did you ever have any really nasty adversarial judgments to deal with?
No, and I think that there have been. And those that there have been, which have gone to a high court in the States, have all involved money.
Mm-hmm.
When there was no money involved, no.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you one very brief story. It was a world championship in the UK, and a lot of European countries and Americans, South Americans, and people from either sides of the then Iron Curtain. And, a protest was handed in. A guy from East Germany claimed that he'd been fouled by a boat from, a, let's say, a Latin country.
Okay.
Anyway, so we, okay, we sent the secretary off to find them, said, we'll hear them in half an hour. Well, half an hour later, in comes the East German, and he has changed, he has trousers on, and he has his national blazer, and he comes in and sits down, and in perfect English, he tells us his story. So we say, yeah, okay, and your the ex-country fellow, and he came in, he's still wet, and his hair is like this, and he comes in and tells, with wild gesticulation, tells his story. So we look at these two stories, and it is black and white. So I was the chair, so I said, you know, we're going to have your crews in. Where are they to be found? So they both said, I will go and fetch my crew. I said, no, you stay here. We will send the secretary to find your crew. So the secretary toddles off, and she comes back later with the two crew members. And the East German crew member comes in and sits down. And his skipper is sent to sit at the back of the room, and he tells his story, and it's a carbon copy of his skipper's. And not only is it carbon copy, it's well prepared. It's well prepared and articulate. Okay. The crew, the Latin American, wasn't Latin American, but Latin European crew, comes in, sits down, tell us your story of the incident. So he tells his story of the incident, and we listen, and it's identical with the East German story.
Mm.
It's identical. So his skipper at the back of the room listens to all this, and in the stunned silence that follows, he leaps to his feet, flings his arms in the air, and says, I capitulate. and of course, everyone breaks up laughing. It was such a funny moment, because the evidence had been X, X, and X, and his was Y, and a complete fiction.
Mm.
So under nasty circumstances, we would have probably sent him home,
mm-hmm.
and back to his parent country. But as it was, he was simply disqualified and given a wigging. But it was so funny. It was just so funny.
So he was trying to...
He was telling the lie direct, and
yeah,
thinking, you know, challenge me if you dare.
So his reason for that would promote his...
To get off the hook, that he didn't foul the other boat.
Okay.
And so if he didn't, we'd have had to have dismissed it as a mistaken thing. So it... There are all kinds of most entertaining things happen.
So when you're sailing the Atlantic, this craft is what, 50 feet?
50 feet, yes.
So what is this, a two-masted sailboat, or that you're taking?
No, it's a sloop. It's a single mast, and the mast is about 65 feet long. So it's.
Do you have backup motor?
We had a diesel. We had a new diesel engine. Yes.
And, what kind of how many knots do you get?
It's a heavy keelboat. Its maximum speed under normal, not weird conditions, is the square root of its waterline length times 1.5. So this boat might, with great effort, get up to 10 or 11 knots.
Oh, wow, okay.
In other words, in a pretty good day's sailing, you might have done 150 nautical miles.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty good going. So it took us 23 days to get to the Azores.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a 20-minute radio telephone slot every day,
mm-hmm.
with a guy who lives in Hamilton, Ontario. A German fellow, and his interest is weather and small boats.
Mm.
And so he would have the synoptic charts of the Atlantic and how everything was moving, and we would have a 20-minute discussion with him And he would say, I suggest you steer significantly further to the north. So this depression will go through below you. And he was great. So I don't think we had about 25 knots was the maximum wind speed we encountered, which is quite a lot of wind, but it's not hairy.
And the seas were not overly.
No. The rough seas I all had in the North Sea. The thing about sailing around the British Isles is that you spend quite a lot of time being cold and wet and frightened, because. 70 knots of wind is really pretty breathtaking. It really is, because the surface of the sea just blows horizontally at you, and the waves are quite big and inclined to break. So we had some gales in the North Sea which were quite memorable. But the boat that I had was very well found. She's done the since John Guthrie sailed her back from the West Indies. To the West Indies was her first. Second, she's done six more Atlantic crossings since 1960 something. So it was a well found boat, only 30 feet overall. But a very classy cruising boat.
So what's it like being out in the middle of the great big Atlantic and there isn't nothing to be seen for miles?
There's always something. The seascape is never the same. It's like going to the desert. I thought the desert would be monotonous. It's not. It changes with every hour of the day as the sun changes the illumination of the ground. The Australian desert is a great place. When we were halfway across, more or less exactly halfway across, it so happened we were becalmed. And so Dan, my son-in-law, broke out a bottle of champagne. So we said, we'll all go for a swim first. So we were becalmed. So we all leapt over the side and swam around the boat, climbed back on board again. It's a bit spooky because the depth of water there is nearly 3,000 metres. And you think, hey, wait a minute, I've got nearly 10,000 feet of water under me to this Atlantic trench. And here am I flannelling about nervously beside the boat. The other surprising thing were turtles. We met turtles. Yep, right out in the middle. And they're going to the West Indies to lay their eggs. Never a dull moment.
Yeah, interesting. That's got to be a great experience for a child. How old was the youngest or oldest the children?
Emma was probably about 12.
Oh, my.
Rachel would have been 10 and Chloe would have been 8. Wow. So they were just kiddies. So when I left them, they went on south to the Canaries. And then they met up with other cruising yachts for the trade wind passage to the West Indies, to the southern West Indies. And they spent the rest of their time in the West Indies. If it had been me, I would have gone to European waters, gone to the Mediterranean and so on, but they wanted to come back.
That's, would be, like I say, a great experience for a child.
Yes.
It's
You could say they're kind of spoiled, really, because that's not so it's not something everybody gets to do.
Outstanding. I don't know if you have any other things that you want to say.
I'm just going to let me just have a quick look at the list you gave me. Okay. Now I haven't had a previous interview. The person I've interacted with far more than any other is Hans Tollau, but far more than anybody else. We just have to sit down together and an idea pops up. It's a great collaboration. They did a Festschrift for Hans not so long ago, and I wrote the story part. This was the one that we had such fun with. They're the Those are the little. Oh, yes. Those are the Buckbee Mears tennis racket thingies on bottom of the page. We had two little tennis racket thingies, which were situated close together.
Crazy. Now, you publish this for you, the editor. You know,
IMS? No, that goes. That would have gone to a different country. That would have gone to the States, or no, that would have gone to Europe.
Okay.
That would have probably gone to Germany or the UK. This was a Hess Schmitz, and yes, I'll leave you with that. That's the editorial, Alan McColl's editorial. For the first of organic mass spectrometry, and his verbal statement at the end was, mass spectrometry is leaving the stamp collecting era. Mm-hmm. And that was right. And if I had to send you a copy of Morris's sonnet.
Oh, that would be excellent. I'd love it to have it.
Come on, where is
it? Yes.
That's Morris's sonnet. Yes, and the others were all doggerel in really Gilbert and Sullivan. It says, 4 months have passed. My paper's deader than if it had been in the shredder. But is it worse or is it better to get the hated reject letter? Shall I send a sharp rebuke with all the subtlety of nuke? Or shall I wait it out in calm, assured that refs can do no harm to work so good? It must go through. More minor changes shall be its due. And it goes on. Where's the mail? This is Morris. Here's the mailman. Holmes be praised. My foulest thoughts are all erased. I can't believe what I am reading. My scientific heart lies bleeding. The referees are both agreed. Major revision is the need. So back to desk and lab again. That damn Canadian is my bane. Oh dear, we kept that going for several manuscripts, and it was. Oh dear.
It lightens up the excitement.
It eases difficult days. Well, you've been very patient.
Well, you've been a very good subject to tell me, a very interesting.